Wolf Hall, Disc 3.
Chapter 2. An Occult History of Britain, 1521 to 1529. Once, in the days of time immemorial, there was a king of Greece who had 33 daughters. Each of these daughters rose up in revolt and murdered her husband. Perplexed as to how he had bred such rebels, but not wanting to kill his own flesh and blood, their princely father exiled them and set them adrift in a rudderless ship. The ship was provisioned for 6 months. By the end of this period, the winds and tides had carried them to the edge of the known earth. They landed on an island shrouded in mist. As it had no name, the eldest of the killers gave it hers, Albina. When they hit shore, they were hungry and avid for male flesh, but there were no men to be found. The island was home only to demons. The 33 princesses mated with the demons and gave birth to a race of giants, who in turn mated with their mothers and produced more of their own kind. These giants spread over the whole landmass of Britain. There were no priests, no churches, and no laws. There was also no way of telling the time. After 8 centuries of rule, they were overthrown by Trojan Brutus. The great-grandson of Aeneas, Brutus was born in Italy. His mother died in giving birth to him, and his father, by accident, he killed with an arrow. He fled his birthplace and became leader of a band of men who had been slaves in Troy. Together they embarked on a voyage north, and the vagaries of wind and tide drove them to Albina's coast, as the sisters had been driven before. When they landed, they were forced to do battle with the giants, led by Gogmagog. The giants were defeated, and their leader thrown into the sea. Whichever way you look at it, it all begins in slaughter. Trojan Brutus and his descendants ruled till the coming of the Romans. Before London was called Ludstown, it was called New Troy, and we were Trojans. Some say the Tudors transcend this history, bloody and demonic as it is, that they descend from Brutus through the line of Constantine, son of St. Helena, who was a Briton. Arthur, High King of Britain, was Constantine's grandson. He married up to 3 women, all called Guinevere, and his tomb is at Glastonbury, but you must understand that he's not really dead, only waiting his time to come again. His blessed descendant, Prince Arthur of England, was born in the year 1486, eldest son of Henry, the first Tudor king. This Arthur married Catherine, the Princess of Aragon, died at 15 and was buried in Worcester Cathedral. If he were alive now, he would be King of England. His younger brother, Henry, would likely be Archbishop of Canterbury, and would not, at least we devoutly hope not, be in pursuit of a woman of whom the Cardinal hears nothing good. A woman to whom, several years before the Duke's war came to despoil him, he will need to turn his attention, whose history, before ruin seizes him, he will need to comprehend. Beneath every history, another history. The lady appeared at court at the Christmas of 1521, dancing in a yellow dress. She was, what, about 20 years old. Daughter of the diplomat Thomas Boleyn, she'd been brought up since childhood in the Burgundian court at Michelin and Brussels, and more recently in Paris, moving in Queen Claude's train between the pretty Chateau of the Loire. Now she speaks her native tongue with a slight, unplaceable accent, strewing her sentences with French words when she pretends she can't think of the English. At Shrovetide, she dances in a court mask. The ladies are costumed as virtues, and she takes the part of perseverance. She dances gracefully but briskly, with an amused expression on her face, a hard, impersonal touch-me-not smile. Soon she has a little trail of petty gentlemen following her, and one not-so-petty gentleman. The rumour spreads that she's going to marry Harry Percy, the Earl of Northumberland's heir. The Cardinal hauls in her father. "Sir Thomas Boleyn," he says, "speak to your daughter or I will. We brought her back from France to marry her into Ireland to the butler's heir. Why does she tarry?"
"The butler's," Sir Thomas begins, and the Cardinal says,
"Oh, yes. The butler's what? Any problem you have there, I'll fix the butler's. What I want to know is,
Did you put her up to it? Conniving in corners with that foolish boy. Because, Sir Thomas, let me make myself plain. I won't have it. The King won't have it. It must be stopped. I have scarcely been in England these last months. Your Grace cannot think that I am party to the scheme. No? You'll be surprised what I can think. Is this your best excuse? That you can't govern your own children? Sir Thomas is looking wry and holding out his hands. He's on the verge of saying young people today, but the Cardinal stops him. The Cardinal suspects, and has confided his suspicion, that the young woman is not enticed by the prospect of Kilkenny Castle and its frugal amenities, nor by the kind of social life that will be available to her when, on special occasions, she hacks on the poor dirt roads to Dublin. "Who's that?" Boleyn says, "in the corner there." The Cardinal waves a hand.
"Just one of my legal people."
"Send him out." The Cardinal sighs. "Is he taking notes of this conversation?"
"Are you, Thomas?" the Cardinal calls. "If so, stop it at once."
Half the world is called Thomas. Afterwards, Boleyn will never be sure if it was him. "Look now, my lord," he says, his voice playing up and down the diplomat's scales. He is frank, a man of the world, and his smile says, now, Wolsey, you're a man of the world too." "They're young." He makes a gesture designed to impersonate frankness. "She caught the boy's eye. It's natural. I've had to break it to her. She knows it can't proceed. She knows her place."
"Good," the Cardinal says, "because it's below a Percy. I mean," he adds, "below in the dynastic sense. I'm not speaking of what one might do in a haystack on a warm night."
He doesn't accept it, the young man. They tell him to marry Mary Talbot, but... And Boleyn gives a little careless laugh. He doesn't care to marry Mary Talbot. He believes he's free to choose his wife.
Choose his...
The Cardinal breaks off.
"I never heard the like. He's not some ploughboy. He's the man who will have to hold the North for us one of these days, and if he doesn't understand his position in the world, then he must learn it or forfeit it. The match already made with Shrewsbury's daughter is a fit match for him, and a match made by me and agreed by the King. And the Earl of Shrewsbury, I can tell you, doesn't take kindly to this sort of moonstruck clowning by a boy who's promised to his daughter."
"The difficulty is..." Boleyn allows a discreet diplomatic pause. "I think that Harry Percy and my daughter, they may have gone a little far in the matter."
"What? You mean we are speaking of a haystack and a warm night?"
From the shadows, he watches. He thinks Boleyn is the coldest, smoothest man he's ever seen. "From what they tell me, they've pledged themselves before witnesses. How can it be undone, then?" The Cardinal smashes his fist on the table.
"I'll tell you how. I shall get his father down from the borders, and if the prodigal defies him, he will be tossed out of his heirdom on his prodigal snout. The Earl has other sons and better. And if you don't want the butler marriage called off, and your lady daughter shrivelling unmarriageable down in Sussex and costing you bed and board for the rest of her life, you will forget any talk of pledges and witnesses. Who are they, these witnesses? I know those kind of witnesses who never show their faces when I send for them. So never let me hear it. Pledges, witnesses, contracts, God in heaven!"
Boleyn is still smiling. He's a poised, slender man. It takes the effort of every finely tuned muscle in his body to keep the smile on his face.
"I do not ask you," says Wolsey, relentless, "whether in this matter you have sought the advice of your relatives in the Howard family. I should be reluctant to think that it was with their agreement that you launched yourself on this scheme. I should be sorry to hear the Duke of Norfolk was apprised of this. Oh, very sorry indeed. So let me not hear it, eh? Go and ask your relatives for some good advice. Marry the girl into Ireland before the butlers hear any rumour that she spoiled goods. Not that I'd mention it, but the court does talk."
Sir Thomas has two spots of angry red on his cheekbones. He says, "Finished, my Lord Cardinal?"
"Yes, go."
Boleyn turns in a sweep of dark silks.
Are those tears of temper in his eyes? The light is dim, but he, Cromwell, is a very strong sight.
"Oh, a moment, Sir Thomas,"
the Cardinal says. His voice loops across the room and pulls his victim back.
"Now, Sir Thomas, remember your ancestry. The Percy family comprise, I do think, the noblest in the land. Whereas, notwithstanding your remarkable good fortune in marrying a Howard, the Boleyns were in trade once, were they not? A person of your name was Lord Mayor of London, not so? Or have I mixed up your line with some Boleyns more distinguished?"
Sir Thomas's face has drained. The scarlet spots have vanished from his cheeks, and he's almost fainting with rage. As he quits the room, he whispers, "Butcher's boy." And as he passes the clerk, whose beefy hand lies idly on his desk, he sneers, "Butcher's dog." The door bangs. The Cardinal says, "Come out, dog." He sits laughing with his elbows on his desk and his head in his hands.
"Mark and learn," he says. "You can never advance your own pedigree, and God knows, Tom, you were born in a more dishonourable estate than me. So the trick is always to keep them scraped up to their own standards. They made the rules. They cannot complain if I am the strictest enforcer. Percy's above Boleyns. Who does he think he is?"
"Is it good policy to make people angry?"
"Oh, no. But it amuses me. My life is hard. I find I want amusement."
The Cardinal casts on him a kindly eye. He suspects he may be this evening's further diversion, now that Boleyn has been torn into strips and dropped on the ground like orange peel.
"Who need one look up to? The Percys, the Staffords, the Howards, the Talbots? Yes, use a long stick to stir them if you must. As for Boleyn, well, the king likes him, and he is an able man, which is why I open all his letters, and have done for years."
"So has your lordship heard? No, forgive me, it is not fit for your ears."
"What?" says the Cardinal.
"It is only rumour. I should not like to mislead your grace."
"You cannot speak and not speak. You must tell me now."
"It's only what the women are saying, the silk women, and the cloth merchants' wives." He waits, smiling. "Which is of no interest to you, I'm sure." Laughing, the Cardinal pushes back his chair, and his shadow rises with him. Firelit, it leaps. His arm darts out, his reach is long. His hand is like the hand of God. But when God closes his hand, his subject is across the room, back to the wall. The Cardinal gives ground. His shadow wavers. It wavers and comes to rest. He is still. The wall records the movement of his breath. His head inclines. In a halo of light, he seems to pause, to examine his handful of nothing. He splays his fingers, his giant, firelit hand. He places it flat on his desk. It vanishes, melted into the cloth of damask. He sits down again. His head is bowed, his face half dark. He, Thomas, also Thomas, Tommaso, and Tomes Cromwell, withdraws his past selves into his present body and edges back to where he was before. His single shadow slides against the wall, a visitor not sure of his welcome. Which of these Thomases saw the blow coming? There are moments when a memory moves right through you. You shy, you duck, you run, or else the past takes your fist and actuates it without the intervention of will. Suppose you have a knife in your fist. That's how murder happens. He says something, the Cardinal says something. They break off. Two sentences go nowhere. The Cardinal resumes his chair. He hesitates before him. He sits down. The Cardinal says,
"I really would like the London gossip, but I wasn't planning to beat it out of you."
The Cardinal bows his head, frowns at a paper on his desk. He's allowing time for the difficult moment to pass. and when he speaks again his tone is measured and easy, like a man telling anecdotes after supper.
When I was a child, my father had a friend, a customer really, who was of florid complexion. He touches his sleeve in illustration. Like this, scarlet. Revel was his name, Miles Revel. His hand drifts to rest again, palm downwards on the blackish damask. For some reason, I used to believe, though I dare say he was an honest citizen and liked a glass of Rhenish, I used to believe he was a drinker of blood. I don't know, some story I suppose that I had heard from my nurse or from some other silly child. And then when my father's apprentices knew about it, only because I was foolish enough to whine and cry, they would shout out, "Here comes Revel for his cup of blood. Run, Thomas Wolsey!" I used to flee as if the devil were after me, put the marketplace between us. I marvel that I didn't fall under a wagon. I used to run and never look. Even today, he says. He picks up a wax seal from the desk, turns it over, puts it down. Even today, when I see a fair, florid man, let us say the Duke of Suffolk, I feel inclined to burst into tears. He pauses. His gaze comes to rest. So, Thomas, can't a cleric stand up unless you think he's after your blood? He picks up the seal again. He turns it over in his fingers. He averts his eyes. He begins to play with words. Would a bishop abash you? A parish clerk panic you? A deacon disconcert? He says, what is the word? I don't know in English. An estoc? Perhaps there is no English word for it. The short-bladed knife that, at close quarters, you push up under the ribs. The cardinal says, and this was? This was some 20 years ago. The lesson is learned and learned well. Night, ice, the still heart of Europe, a forest, lakes silver beneath a pattern of winter stars, a room, firelight, a shape slipping against the wall. He didn't see his assassin, but he saw his shadow move. All the same, says the cardinal, it's 40 years since I saw Master Revel. He will be long dead, I suppose. And your man?
He hesitates.
Long dead too?
It is the most delicate way that can be contrived to ask a man if he's killed someone. And in hell, I should think, if your lordship pleases. That makes Wolsey smile. Not the mention of hell, but the bow to the breadth of his jurisdiction.
So if you attacked the young Cromwell, you went straight to the fiery pit?
If you had seen him, my lord, he was too dirty for purgatory. The blood of the lamb can do much, we are told, but I doubt if it could have wiped this fellow clean.
I'm all for a spotless world, Wolsey says.
He looks sad.
Have you made a good confession?
It was a long time ago.
Have you made a good confession?
My lord cardinal, I was a soldier.
Soldiers have hope of heaven.
He looks up into Wolsey's face. There's no knowing what he believes. He says, we all have that. Soldiers, beggars, sailors, kings.
So, you were a ruffian in your youth, the cardinal says.
Ça fait rien,
he broods.
This dirty fellow who attacked you, he was not, in fact, in holy orders.
He smiles. I didn't ask.
These tricks of memory, the cardinal says. Thomas, I shall try not to move without giving you warning, and in that way we shall do very well together.
But the cardinal looks him over. He's still puzzling. It's early in their association, and his character, as invented by the cardinal, is at this stage a work in progress. In fact, perhaps it is this evening that sets it going. In the years to come, the cardinal will say,
I often wonder about the monastic ideal especially as applied to the young. My servant Cromwell, for instance, his youth was secluded, spent almost entirely in fasting, prayer, and study of the Church Fathers. That's why he's so wild nowadays.
And when people say, is he? Recalling as best they can a man who seems peculiarly discreet. When they say, really, your man Cromwell, the Cardinal will shake his head and say, but I try to mend matters, of course. When he breaks the windows, we just call in the glaziers and part with the cash. As for the procession of aggrieved young women, poor creatures, I pay them off. But tonight he's back to business, hands clasped on his desk, as if holding together the evening past.
Come now, Thomas, you were telling me of a rumour.
The women judge from orders to the silk merchants that the king has a new... He breaks off and says, my lord, what do you call a whore when she's a knight's daughter?
Ah, the cardinal says, entering into the problem. To her face, my lady. Behind her back, well, what is her name? Which knight?
He nods to where 10 minutes ago Boleyn stood. The cardinal looks alarmed.
Why did you not speak up?
How could I have introduced the topic? The cardinal bows to the difficulty. But it is not the Boleyn lady knew at court, not Harry Percy's lady. It is her sister.
I see.
The cardinal drops back in his chair.
Of course.
Mary Boleyn is a kind little blonde, who is said to have been passed all around the French court before coming home to this one, scattering goodwill, her frowning little sister trotting always at her heels.
Of course, I have followed the direction of His Majesty's eye, the Cardinal says.
He nods to himself.
Are they now close? Does the Queen know? Or can't you say?
He nods. The Cardinal sighs.
Catherine is a saint. Still, if I were a saint and a queen, perhaps I would feel I could take no harm from Mary Boleyn. Presents, eh? What sort? Not lavish, you say. I am sorry for her, then. She should seize her advantage while it lasts. It's not that our king has so many adventures, though they do say... They say that when His Majesty was young, not yet king, it was Boleyn's wife who relieved him of his virgin state.
Elizabeth Boleyn. He's not often surprised.
This one's mother. The same. Perhaps the king lacks imagination in that way. Not that I ever believed it. If we were at the other side, you know,
he gestures in the direction of Dover,
we wouldn't even try to keep track of the women. My friend, King Francois, they do say he once oozed up to the lady he'd been with the night before, gave her a formal kiss of the hand, asked her name, and wished they might be better friends.
He bobs his head, liking the success of his story.
But Mary won't cause difficulties. She's an easy armful. The king could do worse.
But her family will want to get something out of it. What did they get before?
The chance to make themselves useful.
Wolsey breaks off and makes a note. He can imagine its content. What Boleyn can have if he asks nicely. The cardinal looks up.
So should I have been in my interview with Sir Thomas, how shall I put it, a more douce?
I don't think my lord could have been sweeter. Witness his face when he left us, the picture of soothed gratification.
Thomas, from now on, any London gossip,
he touches the damask cloth,
bring it right here to me. Don't trouble about the source. Let the trouble be mine, and I promise never to assault you. Truly.
It is forgotten.
I doubt that. Not if you carry the lesson all these years.
The cardinal sits back. He considers.
At least she is married. Mary Boleyn, he means. So if she whelps, he can acknowledge it or not, as he pleases. He has a boy from John Blount's daughter, and he won't want too many.
Too large a royal nursery can be encumbering to a king. The example of history and of other nations shows that the mothers fight for status and try to get their brats induced somehow into the line of succession. The son Henry acknowledges is known as Henry Fitzroy. He's a handsome blonde child made in the king's own image. His father has created him Duke of Somerset and Duke of Richmond. He's not yet 10 years old and the senior nobleman in England. Queen Catherine, whose boys have all died, takes it patiently. That is to say, she suffers. When he leaves the cardinal, he's miserably angry. When he thinks back to his earlier life, that boy half-dead on the cobbles in Putney, he feels no tenderness for him, just a faint impatience. Why doesn't he get up? For his later self, still prone to getting into fights, or at least being in the place where a fight might occur, he feels something like contempt, washed with a queasy anxiety. That was the way of the world. A knife in the dark. A movement on the edge of vision. A series of warnings which have worked themselves into flesh. He has given the cardinal a shock, which is not his job. His job, as he has defined it at this time, is to feed the cardinal information and soothe his temper and understand him and embellish his jokes. What went wrong was an accident of timing only. If the cardinal had not moved so fast, if he had not been so edgy, not knowing how he could signal to him to be less despotic to Boleyn. The trouble with England, he thinks, is that it's so poor in gesture. We shall have to develop a hand signal for back off, our prince is fucking this man's daughter. He is surprised that the Italians have not done it, though perhaps they have, and he just never caught on. In the year 1529, my Lord Cardinal newly disgraced, he will think back to that evening. He's at Esher. It is the lightless, fireless night when the great man has gone to his possibly damp bed. And there is only George Cavendish to keep his spirits alive. What happened next, he asked George, with Harry Percy and Anne Boleyn. He knew the story only in the Cardinal's chilly and dismissive rendition, but George said, I shall tell you how it was. Now, stand up, Master Cromwell. He does it. A little to the left. Now, which would you like to be, my Lord Cardinal or the young heir? Oh, I see. Is it a play? You be the Cardinal. I don't feel equal to it. Cavendish adjusts his position, turning him imperceptibly from the window, where night and bare trees are their audience. His gaze rests on the air, as if he were seeing the past, shadowy bodies moving in this lightless room. Can you look troubled? George asks, as if he were brooding upon mutinous speech and yet dare not speak. No, no, not like that. You are youthful, gangling, your head drooping, you are blushing. Cavendish sighs. I do believe you never blushed in your life, Master Cromwell. Look. Cavendish sets his hands gently on his upper arms. Let us change roles. Sit here. You be the cardinal. At once he sees Cavendish transformed. George twitches, he fumbles, he all but weeps. He becomes the quaking Harry Percy, a young man in love.
Why should I not match with her? He cries, though she be but a simple maid.
Simple? He says, maid. George glares at him.
The cardinal never said that.
Well, not at the time, I agree.
Now, I'm Harry Percy again.
Though she be but a simple maid, her father a mere knight, yet her lineage is good.
She's some sort of cousin of the king's, isn't she?
Some sort of cousin?
Cavendish again breaks up his role indignant.
My Lord Cardinal would have their descent unfolded before him, all drawn up by the heralds.
So what shall I do?
Just pretend. Now, her forebears are not without merit, young Percy argues, but the stronger, the boy argues, the more my Lord Cardinal waxes into a temper.
The boy says, "We have made a contract of matrimony which is as good as a true marriage."
Does he? I mean, did he?
Yes, that was the sense of it. Good as a true marriage.
And what did my Lord Cardinal do there?
He said, "Good God, boy, what are you telling me? If you have involved yourself in any such false proceeding, the King must hear of it. I shall send for your father, and between us, we will contrive to annul this folly of yours."
And Harry Percy said,
"Not much." He hung his head.
I wonder the girl had any respect for him.
But she didn't. She liked his title.
I see.
So then his father came down from the north. "Will you be the Earl, or will you be the boy?"
"The boy. I know how to do it now."
He jumps to his feet and imitates penitence. It seems they had a long talk in a long gallery, the Earl and the Cardinal. Then they had a glass of wine. Something strong, it must have been. The Earl stamped the length of the gallery, then sat down, Cavendish said, on a bench where the waiting boys used to rest between orders. He called his heir to stand before him and took him apart in front of the servants.
"Sir," says Cavendish, "thou hast always been a proud, presumptuous, disdainful, and very unthrift waster."
So that was a good start, wasn't it?
"I like," he says, "the way you remember the exact words. Did you write them down at the time? Or do you use some license?" Cavendish looks sly.
"No one exceeds your own powers of memory," he says. "My Lord Cardinal asks for an accounting of something or other, and you have all the figures at your fingertips."
"Perhaps I invent them."
"Oh, I don't think so." Cavendish is shocked. "You couldn't do that for long."
"It is a method of remembering. I learned it in Italy."
"There are people in this household and elsewhere who would give much to know the whole of what you learned in Italy."
He nods. "Of course they would. But now, where were we? Harry Percy, who is as good as married, you say, to Lady Anne Boleyn, is standing before his father, and the father says..."
"That if he comes into the title, he would be the death of his noble house. He would be the last Earl of Northumberland there ever was. And, 'Praise be to God,' he says, 'I have more choice of boys.' And he stamped off, and the boy was left crying. He had his heart set on Lady Anne, but the Cardinal married him to Mary Talbot, and now they're as miserable as dawn on Ash Wednesday. And the Lady Anne said, well, we all laughed at the time, she said that if she could work my Lord Cardinal any displeasure, she would do it. Can you think how we laughed? Some sallow chit, forgive me, a knight's daughter, to menace my Lord Cardinal. Her nose out of joint because she could not have an earl. But we could not know how she would rise and rise."
He smiles.
"So tell me," Cavendish says, "what did we do wrong?" "I'll tell you. All along, we were misled. The Cardinal, young Harry Percy, his father, you, me. Because when the King said, 'Mistress Anne is not to marry into Northumberland,' I think the King had his eye cast on her all that long time ago."
"While he was close with Mary?"
"He was thinking about Sister Anne."
"Yes, yes." "I wonder," he says, "how it can be that, though all these people think they know the King's pleasure, the King finds himself at every turn impeded. At every turn thwarted, maddened and baffled. The Lady Anne, whom he has chosen to amuse him, while the old wife is cast off and the new wife brought in, refuses to accommodate him at all. How can she refuse? Nobody knows." Cavendish looks downcast because they have not continued the play. "You must be tired," he says. "No, I'm just thinking. How has my Lord Cardinal..." "Missed a trick," he wanted to say, but that is not a respectful way to speak of a cardinal. He looks up. "Go on. What happened next?"
In May 1527, feeling embattled and bad-tempered, the Cardinal opens a court of inquiry at York Place to look into the validity of the King's marriage. It's a secret court. The Queen is not required to appear or even be represented. She's not even supposed to know, but all Europe knows. It is Henry who is ordered to appear and produce the dispensations that allowed him to marry his brother's widow. He does so, and is confident that the court will find the document defective in some way. Wolsey is prepared to say that the marriage is open to doubt, but he does not know, he tells Henry, what the Legatine court can do for him beyond this preparatory step, since Catherine, surely, is bound to appeal to Rome. 6 times, to the world's knowledge, Catherine and the king have lived in hope of an heir. "I remember the winter child," Wolsey says. "I suppose, Thomas, you would not be back in England then. The queen was taken unexpectedly with pains, and the prince was born early, just at the turn of the year. When he was less than an hour old, I held him in my arms, the sleet falling outside the windows, the chamber alive with firelight, the dark coming down by 3 o'clock, and the tracks of birds and beasts covered that night by the snow, every mark of the old world wiped out, and all our pain abolished. We called him the New Year's Prince. We said he would be the richest, the most beautiful, the most devoted. The whole of London was lit up in celebration. He breathed 52 days, and I counted every one of them. I think that if he had lived, our king might have been, I do not say a better king, for that could hardly be, but a more contented Christian. The next child was a boy who died within an hour. In the year 1516, a daughter was born, the Princess Mary, small but vigorous. The year following, the Queen miscarried a male child. Another small princess lived only a few days. Her name would have been Elizabeth, after the King's own mother. Sometimes, says the Cardinal, the King speaks of his mother, Elizabeth Plantagenet, and tears stand in his eyes. She was, you know, a lady of great beauty and calm, so meek under the misfortunes God sent her. She and the old king were blessed with many children, and some of them died. But, says the king, my brother Arthur was born to my mother and father within a year of their marriage, and followed in not too long a time by another goodly son, which was me. So why have I been left after 20 years with one frail daughter whom any vagrant wind may destroy? By now they are, this long-married couple, dragged down by the bewildered consciousness of sin. Perhaps, some people say, it will be a kindness to set them free. I doubt Catherine will think so, the Cardinal says. If the Queen has a sin laid on her conscience, believe me, she will shrive it, if it takes the next 20 years. What have I done? Henry demands of the Cardinal. What have I done? What has she done? What have we done together? There is no answer the Cardinal can make. Even though his heart bleeds for his most benevolent prince, there is no answer he can make, and he detects something not entirely sincere in the question. He thinks, though he will not say so, except in a small room alone with his man of business, that no rational man could worship a god so simply vengeful, and he believes the king is a rational man. Look at the examples before us, he says. Dean Collett, that great scholar. Now, he was one of 22 children, and the only one to live past infancy. Some would suggest that to invite such attrition from above, Sir Henry Collett and his wife must have been monsters of iniquity, infamous through Christendom. But in fact, Sir Henry was Lord Mayor of London twice, and made a very large fortune, so in no way was he slighted by the Almighty, I would say, but rather received every mark of divine favour. It's not the hand of God kills our children. It's disease and hunger and war, rat bites and bad air, and the miasma from plague pits. It's bad harvests like the harvest this year and last year. It's careless nurses. He says to Wolsey, "What age is the Queen now?" "She will be 42, I suppose."
and the king says she can have no more children. My mother was 52 when I was born.
The cardinal stares at him.
Are you sure?
He says. And then he laughs, a merry, easy laugh that makes you think it's good to be a prince of the church. Well, about that anyway. Over 50. They were hazy about these things in the Cromwell family.
And did she survive the ordeal?
She did.
I congratulate both of you. But don't tell people, will you?
The living result of the Queen's labours is the diminutive Mary, not really a whole princess, perhaps two-thirds of one. He has seen her when he has been at court with the Cardinal, and thought she was about the size of his daughter Anne, who is 2 or 3 years younger. Anne Cromwell is a tough little girl. She could eat a princess for breakfast. Like St. Paul's God, she is no respecter of persons, and her eyes, small and steady as her father's, fall coldly on those who cross her. The family joke is what London will be like when our Anne becomes Lord Mayor. Mary Tudor is a pale, clever doll with fox-coloured hair, who speaks with more gravity than the average bishop. She was barely 10 years old when her father sent her to Ludlow to hold court as Princess of Wales. It was where Catherine had been taken as a bride, where her husband Arthur died, when she herself almost died in that year's epidemic, and lay bereft, weakened and forgotten, till the old king's wife paid out of her private purse to have her brought back to London, day by painful day in a litter. Catherine had hidden, she hides so much, any grief at the parting with her daughter. She herself is daughter of a reigning queen. Why should Mary not rule England? She had taken it as a sign that the king was content. But now she knows different. As soon as the secret hearing is convened, Catherine's stored-up grievances come pouring out. According to her, the whole business is the fault of the cardinal.
I told you, Wolsey said. I told you it would be. Look for the hand of the king in it. Look for the will of the king.
No, she cannot do that, for the king in her eyes is immaculate. Ever since Wolsey rose in the king's service, the queen claims, he's been working to push her out of her rightful place as Henry's confidant and adviser. He has used every means he can, she says, to drive me from the king's side, so that I know nothing of his projects, so that he, the cardinal, should have the direction of all. He has prevented my meetings with the ambassador of Spain. He's put spies in my household. My women are all spies for him. The cardinal says wearily, I have never favoured the French, nor the emperor neither. I have favoured peace. I have not stopped her seeing the Spanish ambassador, only made the quite reasonable request that she should not see him alone, so that I might have some check on what insinuations and lies he presents to her. The ladies of her household are English gentlewomen who have a right to wait upon their queen. After almost 30 years in England, would she have nothing but Spaniards? As for driving her from the king's side, how could I do that? For years, his conversation was, the queen must see this, and Catherine would like to hear of this. We must go to her straight away. There never was a lady who knew better her husband's needs. She knows them. For the first time, she doesn't want to comply with them. Is a woman bound to wifely obedience when the result will be to turn her out of the estate of wife? He, Cromwell, admires Catherine. He likes to see her moving about the royal palaces, as wide as she is high, stitched into gowns so bristling with gemstones that they look as if they are designed less for beauty than to withstand blows from a sword. Her auburn hair is faded and streaked with grey, tucked back under her gable hood like the modest wings of a city sparrow. Under her gowns she wears the habit of a Franciscan nun. Try always, Wolsey says, to find out what people wear under their clothes. At an earlier stage in life, this would have surprised him. He had thought that under their clothes, people wore their skin. There are many precedents, the cardinal says, that can help the king in his current concerns. King Louis XII was allowed to set aside his first wife. Nearer home, his own sister Margaret, who had first married the King of Scotland, divorced her second husband and remarried. And the King's great friend Charles Brandon, who is now married to his younger sister Mary, had an earlier alliance put aside in circumstances that hardly bear inquiry. But set against that, the fact that the Church is not in the business of breaking up established marriages or bastardising children. If the dispensation was technically defective, or in any other way defective, why can it not be mended with a new one? So Pope Clement may think, Wolsey says. When he says this, the King shouts. He can shrug that off, the shouting. One grows accustomed, and he watches how the Cardinal behaves as the storm breaks over his head. Half smiling, civil, regretful, he waits for the calm that succeeds it. But Wolsey is becoming uneasy, waiting for Boleyn's daughter. Not the easy armful, but the younger girl, the flat-chested one, to drop her coy negotiations and please the King. If she would do this, the King would take an easier view of life and talk less about his conscience. After all, how could he, in the middle of an amour? But some people suggest that she is bargaining with the King. Some say that she wants to be the new wife, which is laughable, Wolsey says. But then the King is infatuated, so perhaps he doesn't demur, not to her face. He has drawn the Cardinal's attention to the emerald ring Lady Anne now wears, and has told him the provenance and the price. The Cardinal looked shocked. After the Harry Percy debacle, the Cardinal had got Anne sent down to her family house at Hever, but she had insinuated herself back to court somehow, among the Queen's ladies, and now he never knows where she'll be, and whether Henry will disappear from his grasp because he's chasing her across country. He thinks of calling in her father, Sir Thomas, and telling him off again, but even without mentioning the old rumour about Henry and Lady Boleyn, how can you explain to a man that as his first daughter was a whore, so his second one should be too? Insinuating that it's some sort of family business he puts them into. Boleyn is not rich, he says. I'd get him in. Cost it out for him. The credit side, the debit side.
Ah, yes, the Cardinal says. But you are the master of practical solutions, whereas I, as a churchman, have to be careful not actively to recommend that my monarch embark on a studied course of adultery.
He moves the quills around on his desk, shuffles some papers.
Thomas, if you are ever... How shall I put it?
He cannot imagine what the Cardinal might say next.
If you are ever close to the King, if you should find, perhaps, after I'm gone...
It's not easy to speak of non-existence, even if you've already commissioned your tomb. Wolsey cannot imagine a world without Wolsey.
Ah, well, you know I would prefer you to his service and never hold you back, but the difficulty is...
Putney, he means. It is the stark fact. And since he's not a churchman, there are no ecclesiastical titles to soften it, as they have softened the stark fact of Ipswich.
I wonder, Wolsey says, would you have patience with our sovereign lord? When it is midnight and he's up drinking and giggling with Brandon, or singing and the day's paper's not yet signed, and when you press him he says, I'm for my bed now, we're hunting tomorrow. If your chance comes to serve, you will have to take him as he is, a pleasure-loving prince. And he will have to take you as you are, which is rather like one of those square-shaped fighting dogs that low men tow about on ropes. Not that you are without a fitful charm, Tom.
The idea that he or anyone else might come to have Wolsey's hold over the King is about as likely as Anne Cromwell becoming Lord Mayor. But he doesn't altogether discount it. One has heard of Jeanne d'Arc, and it doesn't have to end in flames. He goes home and tells Liz about the fighting dogs. She also thinks it strikingly apt. He doesn't tell her about the fitful charm, in case it's something only the Cardinal can see.
The court of inquiry is just about to break up, leaving the matter for further advisement, when the news comes from Rome that the Emperor's Spanish and German troops, who have not been paid for months, have run wild through the holy city, paying themselves, plundering the treasuries and stoning the artworks. Dressed satirically in stolen vestments, they've raped the wives and virgins of Rome. They've tumbled to the ground statues and nuns and smashed their heads on the pavements. A common soldier has stolen the head of the lance that opened the side of Christ and has attached it to the shaft of his own murderous weapon. His comrades have torn up antique tombs and tipped out the human dust to blow away in the wind. The Tiber brims with fresh bodies, the stabbed and the strangled bobbing against the shore. The most grievous news is that the Pope is taken prisoner. As the young Emperor Charles is nominally in charge of these troops, and presumably will assert his authority and take advantage of the situation, King Henry's matrimonial cause is set back. Charles is the nephew of Queen Catherine, and while he is in the Emperor's hands, Pope Clement is not likely to look favourably on any appeals passed up from the legate in England. Thomas More says that the imperial troops, for their enjoyment, are roasting live babies on spits. Oh, he would, says Thomas Cromwell. Listen, soldiers don't do that. They're too busy carrying away everything they can turn into ready money. Under his clothes, it is well known, More wears a jerkin of horsehair. He beats himself with a small scourge, of the type used by some religious orders. What lodges in his mind, Thomas Cromwell's, is that somebody makes these instruments of daily torture. Someone combs the horsehair into coarse tufts, knots them and chops the blunt ends, knowing that their purpose is to snap off under the skin and irritate it into weeping sores. Is it monks who make them, knotting and snipping in a fury of righteousness, chuckling at the thought of the pain they will cause to persons unknown? Are simple villagers paid, how, by the dozen, for making flails with wax knots? Does it keep farm workers busy during the slow winter months? When the money for their honest labour is put into their hands, do the makers think of the hands that will pick up the product? We don't have to invite pain in, he thinks. It's waiting for us, sooner rather than later. Ask the virgins of Rome. He thinks, also, that people ought to be found better jobs. Let us, says the cardinal at this point, take a step back from the situation. He suffers from genuine alarm. It has always been clear to him that one of the secrets of stability in Europe is to have the papacy independent and in the clutches of neither France nor the Emperor. But his nimble mind is already skipping towards some advantage for Henry. Suppose, he says, for in this emergency it will be to me that Pope Clement looks to hold Christendom together. Suppose I were to cross the Channel, stop off in Calais to reassure our people there and suppress any unhelpful rumours, then travel into France and conduct face-to-face talks with their king, then progress to Avignon, where they know how to host a papal court, and where the butchers and the bakers and the candlestick-makers and the keepers of lodgings and indeed the whores have lived in hope these many years. I would invite the cardinals to meet me and set up a council so that the business of church government could be carried on while His Holiness is suffering the Emperor's hospitality. If the business brought before this council were to include the king's private matter, would we be justified in keeping so Christian a monarch waiting on the resolution of military events in Italy? Might we not rule? It ought not to be beyond the wit of men or angels to send a message to Pope Clement, even in captivity, and the same men or angels will bring a message back, surely endorsing our ruling, for we will have heard the full facts. And when, of course, in due time, and how we all look for that day, Pope Clement is restored to perfect liberty, he will be so grateful for the good order kept in his absence that any little matter of signatures or seals will be a formality. Voila! The King of England will be a bachelor. Before this can happen,
The king has to talk to Catherine. He can't always be hunting somewhere else while she waits for him, patient, implacable, his place set for supper in her private apartments. It's June 1527. Well-barbered and curled, tall, and still trim from certain angles, and wearing white silk, the king makes his way to his wife's apartments. He moves in a perfume cloud made of the essence of roses, as if he owns all the roses, owns all the summer nights. His voice is low, gentle, persuasive, and full of regret. If he were free, he says, if there were no impediment, it is she, above all women, that he would choose for his wife. The lack of sons wouldn't matter. God's will be done. He would like nothing better than to marry her all over again, lawfully this time. But there it is. It can't be managed. She was his brother's wife. Their union has offended divine law. You can hear what Catherine says. That wreck of a body, held together by lacing and stays, encloses a voice that you can hear as far as Calais. It resounds from here to Paris, from here to Madrid, to Rome. She is standing on her status. She is standing on her rights. The windows are rattled from here to Constantinople. What a woman she is, Thomas Cromwell remarks in Spanish, to no one in particular. By mid-July, the cardinal is making his preparations for the voyage across the narrow sea. The warm weather has brought sweating sickness to London, and the city is emptying. A few have gone down already, and many more are imagining they have it, complaining of headaches and pains in their limbs. The gossip in the shops is all about pills and infusions, and friars in the street are doing a lucrative trade in holy medals. This plague came to us in the year 1485, with the armies that brought us the first Henry Tudor. Now, every few years, it fills the graveyards. It kills in a day. Merry at breakfast, they say. Dead by noon. So the cardinal is relieved to be quitting the city, though he cannot embark without the entourage appropriate for a prince of the church. He must persuade King Francois of the efforts he should make in Italy to free Pope Clement by military action. He must assure Francois of the King of England's amity and assistance, but without committing any troops or funds. If God gives him a following wind, he will bring back not only an annulment, but a treaty of mutual aid between England and France, one which will make the young emperor's large jaw quiver and draw a tear from his narrow Habsburg eye. So why is he not more cheerful as he strides about his private chamber at York Place? What will I get, Cromwell, if I gain everything I ask? The Queen, who does not like me, will be cast off, and if the King persists in his folly, the Boleyns brought in, who do not like me either. The girl has a spite against me. Her father I've made a fool of for years, and her uncle Norfolk would see me dead in a ditch. Do you think this plague will be over by the time I return? They say these visitations are all from God, but I can't pretend to know his purposes. While I'm away, you shall get out of the city yourself. He sighs. Is the cardinal his only work? No. He is just the patron who demands the most constant attendance. Business always increases. When he works for the cardinal, in London or elsewhere, he pays his own expenses and those of the staff he sends out on Wolsey's business. The cardinal says, reimburse yourself, and trusts him to take a fair percentage on top. He doesn't quibble, because what is good for Thomas Cromwell is good for Thomas Wolsey, and vice versa. His legal practice is thriving, and he is able to lend money at interest and arrange bigger loans on the international market, taking a broker's fee. The market is volatile. The news from Italy is never good 2 days together. But as some men have an eye for horse flesh or cattle to be fattened, he has an eye for risk. A number of noblemen are indebted to him, not just for arranging loans, but for making their estates pay better. It is not a matter of exactions from tenants, but in the first place, giving the landowner an accurate survey of land values, crop yield, water supply, built assets, and then assessing the potential of all these. Next, putting in bright people as estate managers, and with them setting up an accounting system that makes yearly sense and can be audited. Among the city merchants, he is in demand for his advice on trading partners overseas. He has a sideline in arbitration, commercial disputes mostly, as his ability to assess the facts of a case and give a swift, impartial decision is trusted here, in Calais and in Antwerp. If you and your opponent can at least concur on the need to save the costs and delays of a court hearing, then Cromwell is, for a fee, your man. And he has the pleasant privilege, often enough, of sending away both sides happy. These are good days for him. Every day a fight he can win.
"Still serving your Hebrew god, I see," remarks Sir Thomas More. "I mean your idle usury."
But when More, a scholar revered through Europe, wakes up in Chelsea to the prospect of morning prayers in Latin, he wakes up to a creator who speaks the swift patois of the markets. When More is settling in for a session of self-scourging, he and Rafe are sprinting to Lombard Street to get the day's exchange rates. Not that he sprints, quite. An old injury drags sometimes, and when he's tired, a foot turns inward, as if he's walking back towards himself. People suggest it is the legacy of a summer with Cesare Borgia. He likes the stories they tell about him. But where's Cesare now? He's dead. Thomas Cromwell, people say, that is an ingenious man. Do you know that he has the whole of the New Testament by heart? He is the very man if an argument about God breaks out. He's the very man for telling your tenants 12 good reasons why their rents are fair. He is the man to cut through some legal entanglement that's ensnared you for 3 generations, or talk your sniffling little daughter into the marriage she swears she will never make. With animals, women, and timid litigants, his manner is gentle and easy, but he makes your creditors weep. He can converse with you about the Caesars, or get you Venetian glassware at a very reasonable rate. Nobody can outtalk him if he wants to talk. Nobody can better keep their head when markets are falling and weeping men are standing on the street tearing up letters of credit. "Liz," he says one night, "I believe that in a year or two we'll be rich." She's embroidering shirts for Gregory with a black work design. It's the same one the Queen uses, for she makes the King's shirts herself. "If I were Catherine, I'd leave the needle in them," he says. She grins. "I know you would." Lizzie had grown silent and stern when he told her how the king had spoken at the meeting with Catherine. He had told her they should separate, pending a judgment on their marriage. Perhaps she would retire from court. Catherine had said no. She said that would not be possible. She said she would seek advice from canon lawyers, and that he, himself, should equip himself with better lawyers and better priests. And then, after the shouting was done, the people with their ears pressed to the walls had heard Catherine crying. "He doesn't like her crying." "Men say," Liz reaches for her scissors, "I can't endure it when women cry, just as people say, I can't endure this wet weather. As if it were nothing to do with the men at all, the crying. Just one of those things that happen." "I've never made you cry, have I?" "Only with laughter," she says. Conversation fades into an easy silence. She is embroidering her own thoughts. He is plotting what to do with his money. He is supporting 2 young scholars not belonging to the family through Cambridge University. The gift blesses the giver. "I could increase those endowments," he thinks, "and I suppose I should make a will," he says. She reaches out for his hand. "Tom, don't die."
"Good God, no, I'm not proposing it."
He thinks, "I may not be rich yet, but I am lucky. Look how I got out from under Walter's boots, from Cesare's summer, and a score of bad nights in back alleys. Men, it is supposed,
want to pass their wisdom to their sons. He would give a great deal to protect his own son from a quarter of what he knows. Where does Gregory's sweet nature come from? It must be the result of his mother's prayers. Richard Williams, Cat's boy, is sharp, keen and forward. Christopher, his sister Bet's boy, is clever and willing too. And then he has Rafe Sadler, whom he trusts as he would trust his son. It's not a dynasty, he thinks, but it's a start. And quiet moments like this are rare, because his house is full of people every day. People who want to be taken to the cardinal. There are artists looking for a subject. There are solemn Dutch scholars with books under their arms. And Lübeck merchants unwinding at length solemn Germanic jokes. There are musicians in transit tuning up strange instruments. And noisy conclaves of agents for the Italian banks. There are alchemists offering recipes. And astrologers offering favourable fates. And lonely Polish fur traders who've wandered by to see if someone speaks their language. There are printers, engravers, translators, and cipherers, and poets, garden designers, cabalists, and geometricians. Where are they tonight? Hush, Liz says. Listen to the house. At first there is no sound. Then the timbers creak, breathe. In the chimneys nesting birds shuffle. A breeze blows from the river, faintly shivering the tops of trees. They hear the sleeping breath of children, imagined from other rooms. Come to bed, he says. The king can't say that to his wife, or with any good effect to the woman they say he loves.
This ends Disc 3.